The Bible tells us quite a bit about what Judas did when he was betraying Jesus. How he was there at the supper, how he was there having the dialogue with Jesus. Jesus told him, what you have to do, do quickly. And he went out and he completed the task of betraying our Lord. The Bible also tells us quite a bit about what Peter did. As he, along with the other disciples that were left, had all said to Jesus, even if we have to die with you, we will not deny you. Yet Peter's account of his denials are listed throughout the Gospels. And we see how this man who was so sure of himself, was so confident of his own faith in Jesus, was able there to stand and to even curse, denying that he knew Jesus Christ. The Bible tells us quite a bit also about those six trials or interactions that Jesus had. And the night of his betrayal up to the day of his crucifixion, how he was taken and how he met three times in front of the Jewish authorities and then three times in front of the Roman authorities as they were preparing to condemn him for his death. But when it comes to the crucifixion, the gospel accounts say they crucified him. Details are given beforehand about the flogging, about Jesus carrying the cross, and about those other types of things, but not in great detail about how they affixed him to the cross or how bad that part was. Details are given also about the sayings that Jesus had while he's on the cross, but the actual process of him being crucified, they simply say, and they crucified him. I've spoken with several people who have been in combat over the years, and we appreciate so much any of our friends and all of those that we know who have served our country and have put their lives on the line. And those people who come back from a combat zone, they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to go see the movies that replay it. They don't want to see those details again because it's too painful, too gory. It doesn't accomplish anything. And as we think about the crucifixion today, as we go through this series on the last days of Jesus, I want you to realize that this isn't some gory detail fest of entertainment that we're looking at. Some of the movies that have depicted the crucifixion have been extremely realistic and extremely detailed in how the flogging and how all the pain, suffering, and the blood loss and the eventual death of Jesus played out. And that's got its benefit for us to see and to realize and let that come back to us. Because all too often, friends, what we do, we focus on the good news, which is Jesus is not still in the tomb. And sometimes we don't take for full value the fact that Jesus died for us. Jesus died so we might live. I want us to begin, we're going to begin over in the book of John, but all four of the gospel accounts are going to tell about the crucifixion of Jesus. Matthew chapter 27, Mark chapter 15, Luke chapter 23, and really then just John chapter 19, but I've got 18 there as well because we're going to begin there in just a moment. And as we review these events before the cross and also on the cross, I want us to remember that Jesus Christ died so that we might live. I want you to remember that theme throughout this. Jesus Christ died so that we might live. Carl and I have a good friend of ours from Lewisburg who just recently had been the recipient of lung transplant. Somebody had to die for him to be able to have those new lungs so that he might prolong his life. How do you think that would make you feel if the next day of your life was dependent on somebody dying so that you might be able to live? I don't know that any of us here are recipients of a transplanted organ that was the result of someone else dying so that we might live. Somebody might be here that I'm not aware of. But I could tell you this, if my life depended on someone else's death, and if their death by the consequences of an accident or whatever caused me to live, I would forever be indebted to them. I would take every day of my life from that point forward and I would say, I am so thankful to God that I can live. I'm thankful for whatever happened, the tragedy in that family that caused that death and allowed me to live again. I would not take any day for granted. I would not abuse this body. I would not do anything that would shorten the extended life that I have because someone died for me. And friends, when we think about the crucifixion, we need to remember someone died for us. So let's look at that now as we begin in John chapter 18. Let's begin just a short review here of the trial. We covered this last week in Pilate's court now, verse 28. Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the Praetorium, and it was early morning. But they themselves did not go into the praetorium, lest that they should be defiled, for they that they might enter and eat the Passover. Pilate then went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" You may recall from Sunday night that we talked about four things in a Roman court that would be required. The first is here with the accusation. Later in verse 33, we'll have the interrogation. The third thing is the defense, which Jesus was not allowed to have someone to defend him. He does answer back to Pilate. And then the fourth thing is the verdict. So let's read on here in verse 30. Then they answered and said to him, "If he were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you." Then Pilate said to them, "You take him and judge him according to your law." Therefore the Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." Oh, this is a capital offense. That changes things, because the Jews were not in a position under law to put someone to death, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled which he spoke, signifying by which what death he would die. Then Pilate entered the praetorium again and called Jesus and said to him, here's the interrogation, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered him, "Are you speaking for yourself about this, or did others tell you this concerning me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here." Pilate therefore said to him, "Are you a king then?" Jesus answered, "You say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." And Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out and again to the Jews and said to him, "Them, I find no fault in him at all." That's the verdict. That's the fourth of those four Roman things required in a trial. In this setting, we find this trial of six different times that Jesus is in front of those who are in authority. Let's turn now over to Matthew chapter 27. And I want us to look at some of the other issues that lead up now to Jesus' death. We find about Barabbas. Let's begin in verse 15 of Matthew chapter 27. As Pilate is now trying to appease the crowds that are around. "Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to releasing the multitude to the multitudes one prisoner whom they wished. And at that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. And therefore, they had gathered together. When they had gathered together, Pilate said to them, 'Whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called the Christ?' For they knew that they had handed him over because of envy." Envy is a terrible thing here. All throughout the Bible, we're told about these sins and problems that come into our heart that cause us to act in ways that are not right. So envy was the cause that the Jews turned them over to Pilate. "While he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, 'Have nothing to do with this just man, for I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him.' But the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitudes that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus." Here again, we find this power play being played out over and over again as the Jews see their power structure, their authority being threatened by Jesus, and they will stop at nothing to see Jesus taken out of the way. They are persuading the multitudes so that they might destroy Jesus. Verse 21, "The governor answered and said to them, 'Which of the two do you want me to release to you?' And they said, 'Barabbas.' Pilate then said to them, 'What shall I do then with Jesus, who is called the Christ?' And they all said to him, 'Let him be crucified.' Then the governor said, 'Why? What evil has he done?'" You see, he already knows he's innocent. He doesn't see the charges from the Jewish side to amount to anything. He doesn't see anything from the Roman side either. But they cried out all the more, saying, "Let him be crucified." When Pilate saw what he had that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was rising, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, "I am innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it." And then all the people answered and said, "His blood be on us and on our children." So here we find Jesus is in this exchange with Barabbas. And Pilate, knowing that he's innocent, he washes his hands symbolically. And we have this phrase today, "I'm going to wash my hands of this situation. I'm going to back away from it. I'm not responsible anymore for what happens in this situation." But Pilate is responsible. Pilate is responsible. He's in a tough fix right now in his life. He's got a lot of problems from high up, down from Rome, and because of uprisings in his area. Now he's got this uprising with the Jews. He's caught in the middle. He doesn't know what to do. His wife says, back off of this. Don't have anything to do with this man. And he finds a solution in his mind. I'm just going to give him up to them, wash my hands, and I'm done. And here we go. Jesus has another opportunity that's passing by for him to have justice. We find then in verse 26, the Pilate releases Barabbas to them, and when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. The scourging is not a sight for weak stomachs. We get pain inflicted on our bodies from time to time. I remember shutting my fingers in a car door once. And just the thought of that just makes me cringe today. But I have never encountered any pain like a scourging. The scourging of Jesus takes place. There's a mocking that's going to take place as well. I won't go into great detail except to say this. You and I have never encountered the type of pain that Jesus endured. And Jesus died for us. He was stretched out over a post or over a stump or something of the sort that would be in a courtyard. He was stretched out over there. He's been tied all of this time through his trials. Now he's being stretched out. His back is tight. And as the men then take that whip, they begin to scourge him. They begin to beat him. And as they whip into his flesh, the end of the whip is not just a tail. It's several tails flailed out. And at the end of those tails are bits of metal or bone or stone that are embedded, tied off to the end of that. And they're jagged edges so that as the whip comes back and as they pull it back, that tail of the whip will hold into the flesh and then it will dig in. And then as they pull the whip back, it will pull the flesh and rip it open. It's a bloody scene. His skin being tight around that time when the skin is split, it splits. It's a very painful process he goes through. But the Bible says that he was scourged. Let's go on now to verses 27 through 31. He was also mocked. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus to the praetorium and gathered the whole garrison around him. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. Now, the scarlet robe isn't like a royal robe. What most likely this is a military type overcoat that they would have. They'd have lots of these laying around as their military issue. And so it's likely faded from a more brilliant color. And so they took this robe and they put it on Jesus. And so scarlet, purple, those types of things would denote royalty. But this is most likely a robe that's been around, it's been faded, and they put the scarlet robe on him. And then when they had twisted a crown of thorns, and you can see here just a small depiction of these thorns here. And on the first screen, it showed larger thorns. We're not talking about the types of thorns that might be on your rose bushes, but we're talking about these larger thorns that would be there. They took those vines with the thorns on them. They twisted them around and made a crown that fit on his head. So if you can imagine wearing a crown, now you would find that a laurel or some other type of crown would be there for those people of royalty. They fashioned a crown out of these thorns. And then they placed that on his head. And they took a reed and put it in his right hand. That would indicate the sepulcher, okay? That would also be a royal type of thing. Now, this reed would be something not very, it's not going to be like a bamboo stick. A reed is going to be somewhat flimsy. But as they take that reed, they put it in his hand. And then they bowed the knee before him, and they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." Now, there will be a day that every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, the Savior of the world. But this is not that day. They are bowing the knee to Jesus, not because they believe him, but because they're mocking him. And then they spat on him and they took the reed then from his hand and they struck him on the head. Now, imagine again that you're there and you've got this crown of thorns on your head. And now it's beating that crown of thorns, beating those thorns deeper into the skin, deeper into the skull. And when they had mocked him, they took the robe off him and put on his own clothes on it and led him away to be crucified. This is God's Son. This is God's Son that's enduring this for you and for me. He's standing there. He's taking it. Prophecy says he's not going to revile others. He's not going to give evil for evil. He's not going to defend himself. He's going to be like the lamb before a shear. He's silent. And he endures this for us. And then it says in verse 32 that he carries his cross. John says this as well in John 19, verse 17, that Jesus bears his cross. Now, as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name, and they compelled him to bear his cross. Jesus says for us to take up our cross and follow after him. Deny ourselves, take up our cross, follow after him. That's a great formula. Deny yourself, take up your cross, follow after me. What am I supposed to do? Deny yourself. Don't be selfish about things. Remember, somebody died for you. You've got to do something now to honor and to follow them. So Jesus says, deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow after me. Now, taking up your cross, what does this entail? Well, there are various types of crosses that might have been used for Roman executions. And Romans were very good at this process of crucifying people. They've really taken it up to an art form of sorts. Because crucifixion was not meant to be a quick death. It was not meant merely to be an example to others. It was meant to prolong the life of a person in as much pain and agony as possible. The Romans were noted for leaving people up on the crosses as long as they could, or having these crucifixions at main thoroughfares so that everyone who came by could look up and see this as an example of what not to do. Romans ruled with an iron fist. They did not want people to have an uprising. There were some crosses that would be simply just a stake in the ground where they would hang a person. There would be some in the form of an X, some in the form of a Y that would go out. Some crosses as well would have been like a capital T, where you had the crossbeam comes over the top then of a post in the ground. Most likely the cross that Jesus has is the one that we most likely see like a small T, where there's some of the post that juts up above the crossbeam. The manner of affixing a person to the cross changed from time to time as well. You might have them lashed to the cross with ropes or with leather bands. You might also have them nailed to the cross as Jesus was. Only John mentions the fact that nails were used in the crucifixion. Had it not been for Thomas saying, unless I see the print of the nails in his hands and put my fingers in the print of his nails, I will not believe. Had Thomas not been recorded saying that, we would not know for sure that he was nailed to the cross as opposed to affixed to the cross from the gospel accounts. But Jesus is there. Sometimes also on the cross, they would have a peg of sorts around the waist area so the body could rest, not for relief, but again so that it could prolong the agony and prolong the death of the person that's on the cross. But they are carrying the cross now for Jesus. He's been through this night where his disciples couldn't stay awake with him long enough to guard him. Now he's gone through the trials. He's gone through the scourging. He's now in the daytime, the early morning hours. The amount of blood loss is something we can't fathom. And now Jesus is taking his cross. There's no direct description of the cross here, but the speculation is that it's the entire cross. Sometimes people would only take the crossbeam of the cross, which would be quite a feat in itself, but this would be the entire cross, and some have estimated that to be around 200 pounds. Jesus now needs assistance, and so Simon of Cyrene is taken on to be assistant for him. I want to read on just a little bit more in Matthew's account here. Let's go on to verse 33. And when they had come to a place called Golgotha, that is to say the place of the skull, then they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. But when he had tasted it, he would not drink. Now, this wine that they're giving him mixed with gall, and another gospel account says it's myrrh, it's going to be bitters, bitters being put in that. And the purpose of that is kind of like a sedative or a numbing agent of sort, okay? If I go to the dentist, I want a numbing agent, okay? I don't want that dentist climbing on my chest trying to extract a tooth or drill on me without having a numbing agent. I don't want to feel the pain. Jesus is offered now this wine mixed with gall or myrrh, which is a bitter, which is a numbing agent. He's offered this. When he tastes it, he doesn't partake of it. He doesn't want to have his senses numbed. He wants to feel every pain that is coming his way. He's dying for us. He doesn't want his senses numbed. He wants everything to be there, to be something that he experiences. And then they crucified him. You see, that's all Matthew says about it. Then they crucified him. It doesn't say that they laid him down on his cross and they held his hand out and then they drove the spikes into his hands. By the way, when they drive the stakes into his hands, many people think it's going to be through the palm. I don't believe that that's the case. I believe it's more likely through the wrist. If you were to drive one of these nails or stakes through his palm here, and think in terms of like a railroad spike, okay, only sharper at the end but yet going out. If you were to drive that through the hand, most likely you would break and shatter the bones that are there supporting your fingers. But the prophecy says that not one bone of his body shall be broken. Also, if you do that there, the weight of the body will rip through, and that will not be sufficient to hold the body up. So most likely the nails were through the wrist. And if you feel on your wrist right now, you'll feel the two bones coming together and the tendons and all the things that are there to hold that marvelous hand in place are sufficient to hold the body. When it comes to his feet, most likely they would take his feet and would turn them and would drive one stake that would go around where the Achilles tendon is, also a very high support area, so that they would have the three nails there. When they crucified him and divided his garments, casting lots, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, they divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Sitting down, they kept watch over him there. And then they put over his head the accusation written against him, "This is Jesus, King of the Jews." Then the two robbers who were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left, and then those who were passing by blasphemed him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." Likewise, the chief priests also, mocking with scribes and elders, said, "He saved others, himself he cannot save. If he is the King of Israel, let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe him. He trusted in God, let him deliver him now, if he will save him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" And even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him with the same thing. So here we have more of Matthew's account of what's going on here. What about on the cross? Well, I mentioned this already. Very little is actually said about his time on the cross. The sign, we just read a version of that here in Matthew. The different accounts give slightly different versions. If we go over to chapter 19 of John, we find verses 17 through 22 telling us some more. "And he, bearing his cross, went out to the place called the place of the skull, which is called in Hebrew Golgotha, where they crucified him." Again, it's just one word to describe the act. "And two others with him, one on either side, and Jesus in the center." Now, Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross, and the writing was, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." Now, many of the Jews read this title, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city. Again, the Romans wanted to crucify people near the main thoroughfare, so everyone could see and see this as an example. The Jews now see the sign, and they know others are going to read it, and so they began to argue with Pilate, saying, "Do not write the King of the Jews, but he said, 'I am the King of the Jews.'" But Pilate answered and said, "What I have written, I have written." So Pilate's growing a bit of a backbone now, standing in his place, saying that, "Look, he's innocent. I'm allowing you to kill him through this process, but I'm not going to go fully along with your way." Luke records, as others do, that Jesus is between two robbers. And by the way, as we go through these, there are Old Testament and New Testament prophecies that go along with the betrayal and the mocking and the death and certainly the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Some 300 messianic prophecies are looking at this whole process of Jesus being the Son of God, his manner of birth, where he was born, how he would live, the fact that he was sinless, the fact that none of his bones would be broken, all of these things. And with that, it's fascinating study that we can't get into this morning, but needless to say, 300 different prophecies concerning him. If we go over to Luke chapter 23, we find some more mocking here, verses 35 through 39. "And the people stood looking on, but even the rulers with them sneered, saying, 'He saved others, and let him save himself, if he is the Christ, the chosen of God.' The soldiers also mocked him, coming and offering him sour wine and saying, 'If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself.' And then the inscription was also written over him in the letters of Greek, Latin, and Hebrew, 'This is the King of the Jews.' And then one of the criminals who was with were hanged with him, blaspheming him also, saying, if you are the Christ, save yourself and us. The fact here that this mentions that the inscription was written over him in the letters indicates maybe that was the cross that was like the small T, and that they were using that portion up there. Now, on the cross, there are sayings of Jesus as well. I'm not going to have you to read these passages, but you can write them down in your notes. But of these sayings of Jesus, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. This is likely in the beginning stages of the process of crucifixion, maybe even while he's on the ground as they're nailing him up on the cross. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Now, I guarantee you that the people who are holding the spike and holding the hammer and about to affix Jesus to the cross, they know exactly what they are doing. They're soldiers of the Roman army. They've been trained for this. They take some perverse pleasure, not only in the crucifixion, but also in the mocking and the belittlement of a person before his death. They know exactly what they're doing. The people who are physically doing this know exactly what they're doing. The Jews that are looking on, they know exactly what they're doing. They've worked for this day. They've longed for this day. Yet Jesus says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. They know exactly what they are doing. Yet later we'll find a writer that says, if they knew what they were doing, they would not have crucified God's Son. Jesus says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Now, Jesus is making a direct appeal to God. But understand that that doesn't let them off the hook. Some 7 weeks later, Peter's going to stand on the day of Pentecost, and he's going to go out to this grand audience of people, and he and the others are going to be preaching this sermon saying, you killed Jesus Christ, who is the Son of God. And they are going to be convinced in their hearts that they've done this, that they have killed God's Son. They're going to cry out, men and brethren, what shall we do? And Peter's going to say, repent and be baptized, because they're still in their sins for that. The second saying then is going to come up. This is also in Luke chapter 23 and verse 43. Today you will be with me in paradise. Those two thieves, one on the left, one on the right, are there and they're mocking him. But one turns then and he begins to say things to Jesus that indicates he believes that Jesus is the Son of God. And Jesus tells him, today you will be with me in paradise. In John chapter 19, John refers to this section. And as John goes through, John never mentions himself by name throughout the gospel, but he is the disciple whom Jesus loved. And John is there witnessing the crucifixion. The other disciples have all scattered. And John is there along with Jesus' mother and the other Marys that are there. And Jesus looks down and says, behold your son and behold your mother. Jesus is not saying to Mary, his mother, behold your son, it's to look at me, but rather the connection there with the disciple whom Jesus loved. Woman, behold your son and behold your mother. In other words, this is the transfer of responsibility. As a son would have responsibility to keep up the parents when they got older, Jesus now being ready to die is not able to do that. And so he says, woman, behold your son and son, behold your mother. Now you might say, well, Jesus had other brothers. Why didn't he entrust his mother into their care? Because they did not believe on him. You might recall that earlier, that Jesus' brothers who were named by name did not believe on him until after the resurrection. Another statement he says here towards the end. My God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus prayed in the garden so hard that blood was coming out of sweat. And he prayed in the garden, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. But if it is not, then your will and not my will be done. And now in this hour nearing his death, he's up there in the agonizing pain. And we won't go through all the pain, but the process of dying in a crucifixion, suffocation is one way, heart failure is another way, but it's extremely grueling, extremely difficult death. And he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? In John chapter 19, right before he utters his last words, he says, I thirst. They bring him now some of this wine on a sponge and hold it up on a piece of hyssop. Taste it just enough to wet his lips. And then he says, it is finished. He bows his head and he dies. He dies before others think he would. The two thieves are still alive. It's a day of preparation before the Passover, and so they can't leave the bodies up there, and you know how this story goes on. But he dies. It is finished. Into your hands I commit my spirit. We read these four accounts of the Gospels. We begin to put these details into place. We begin to realize Jesus Christ died for us. He endured all of that for us. We wear his name today, but sometimes we don't do it in the way that we should. Sometimes as Christians, we don't act in the way that we should, and so we portray what Jesus is to us, to the world, in a way that belittles Jesus and undercuts his real authority in this world, because we forget that Jesus Christ died for us. He really did. At his death, there's a centurion, and he says, "Truly this was the Son of God." I realize that there are other details in this that we could have gone through this morning, but I want you to get the real story. I want you to go through, as I mentioned in weeks past, I want you to go through and read these gospel accounts. Read all four of the gospel accounts taking up in this last few days of Jesus' life. I want you to read about how Jesus interacts with Judas. I want you to read how Jesus confronts a very boastful Peter. I want you to read about how Jesus is praying so hard in the garden as he knows that his accuser and betrayer and all the soldiers are about to take him. I want you to read about how Jesus faces the inhumane way that he is treated and how people are beating upon him and causing him to have great pain and telling him, "Don't you know what power I have?" Yet Jesus knows he has all the power. I want you to realize what Jesus did, that he did that in the face of every single one that spat upon him and mocked him, who drove the nails into his hands and who condemned him to death. And Jesus did every bit of that for those people. He died for them. And he died for us as well. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever should believe in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. That God demonstrates his love toward us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Boy, that's the part that we sometimes miss. I wanted to have this series where we looked at the last week of Jesus, because some places, they really get critical if you talk about the resurrection around Easter, and they say, "Well, that's not right." And listen, this is the story of Jesus. This is what the world is looking for. This series of lessons here is designed to help us to understand what Jesus has really done for us. And before we jump into the resurrection and celebrate the fact that he's no longer in the tomb, I want us to realize that Christ died for us. Jesus died for us. He did all of this for us. Like our friend that got the new set of lungs, somebody had to die so that they could open him up and put someone else's lungs into his body to allow him to live the next day. He's so appreciative. He's not happy that somebody died, but through somebody else's death, he's able to live. And I tell you what, when he leaves that place in Dallas and when he goes back to Tennessee, he's not ever going to go against what the doctors say to do to keep that set of lungs working in his body. He's going to treasure them. He's going to treasure each day and each moment on this earth, because someone died so that he might live. And friends, any time that we start to think about being selfish and acting in ways that God would not be proud of us to act, I want us to remember that Jesus Christ died for us. I'm ashamed and I'm embarrassed about how some Christians in the world act today. Oh, they play out in ways that aren't even Christ-like in the least. And yet they hide behind the fact that they're a Christian. That ought to make it all right for them to act out in certain ways. It's not. We are the light of the world, the salt of the earth. We're to be the ones by whom others can know Jesus because of the life that we live. Paul writes it this way when he says we are ambassadors for Christ. And so, God, we're pleading through us, we implore you on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God. Friends, we have a song of encouragement that's been selected for this morning. And if you're not with God, reconciled with God as a child of God already, who has put on Christ in baptism, turned over your sins to be washed away in the blood that was shed for you, then you need to take that step. And if you're out of step with God today, then let's do something to put you back in step with God. We stand ready to assist you through prayer. We can do this publicly. You can respond during the invitation. We'll pray with you, and all of these people will surround you with love. Or we can set off to a side later, and we can sit, and we can spend all the time that you need. But we want you to realize that you need to be right with God. Jesus Christ did all of this so that we might live with hope of eternal life. Don't let his price for your soul be wasted. If you have need of coming, come now while we stand and sing.